Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Thank you for tuning in. Today, we will continue with Tom Kohler's reading of Minnesota author Dean Hovey's book, Whistling Pines, a lighthearted mystery set in a fictional Two Harbors senior care facility. We'll pick up where Tom left off last time.
My mind was racing as Ginny stepped away. I hadn't thought about a funeral for Axel. Based on past history, nearly two-thirds of the residents would attend, and at least half would need a ride. Our handicapped accessible van seats only 16 people, so I'd have to make arrangements for a motor coach to transport the more ambulatory, and I'd have to line up volunteers and staff to assist with the transport and the headcounts on each end. It was going to be a long Monday with no way to separate my day job from the investigative job Len had assigned me. I was pinning on my name tag when Howard Johnson, tall and lean with a head of snow-white hair, came walking down the hallway. He always carried himself with military bearing, and his stride was measured. He wore a neatly pressed yellow shirt under a brown cardigan. His khaki slacks had a sharp crease. Howard was the unofficial mayor of Whistling Pines and was very serious about his responsibilities to represent the interests of the residents when speaking with the management and staff. "Howard, do you have a second?" I called. "I always have a second for you, Peter," he said, a pleasant smile crossing his face. "Tell me about Axel." The smile disappeared. "I don't really have anything to say about Axel." "Let me guess. You live by the motto, if you can't say something good about someone, say nothing." Howard nodded, saying, "I've rarely regretted something I didn't say." "I understand that you and Axel weren't buddies, but I must have seen you talking to him a few times. What was he like?" "I wouldn't have peed on his head if his hair was on fire," Howard said. Immediately, his face reddened. "I'm terribly sorry. That was really uncalled for," he said. "Did something happen between you?" "Nothing specific. Axel was just a general pain in the posterior." "Give me an example." "Well, he was always proud of his Swedish heritage. He belonged to the Sons of Sweden and had a little Swedish flag on his door. The truth was that his family was Finland Svensk, Swede Finn from Finland. His family has probably lived in Finland since Columbus landed in the New World. Worse than that, he claimed that he was some sort of war hero. He had that silly picture of some officer pinning a medal on him in Korea. The rumor around town was that he got a good conduct medal for not contracting a social disease while stationed in Seoul." He paused and considered his words. "I suppose he may have earned a medal, claiming that he'd fought at the Chosun River when the Chinese invaded Korea. On the other hand, I've heard that he worked with the Finnish underground when they were allied with the Nazis, although it was never really clear which side he was on. When I was in Europe at the end of the war, I heard that the Finnish intelligence service had done things that made the German Gestapo look like schoolyard bullies." "Oh," was the only immediate response that came to mind. "I don't recall any of that from my history classes." John Dahlin was passing by, and Howard hailed him, "Junior, do you have a second?" John was a stooped man who used a wheeled walker. He'd always been rather quiet and only spoke to me when directly questioned. He was wheezing by the time he wheeled over to Howard and me. He wore a short goatee stained from the Copenhagen snuff he kept inside his lower lip. The stain expanded down to the front of his plaid shirt and stopped just short of his belt, which had been adjusted greatly over the years, showing a half dozen worn holes from the days when his waistline was smaller. "What do you know about Axel and where he was during the war, Junior?" Howard asked. "Don't know much," John replied. I was in the Pacific with the Marines. I heard he was somewhere in Europe. He ever talked to you about being in Finland? Not much, John replied. He mostly liked to remind me about how smart he was and how dumb I was. Someone told him that I'd spent 3 years as a junior in high school, and that's why they called me Junior. I guess he thought it was funny. Howard shook his head. Yeah, that sounds like Axel. He liked to pile on someone who was down, even when he didn't know the whole story. Howard turned to me and explained. Junior had to drop out of school in 41 when his father got kicked by a horse, then had to quit again in 42 when his brother enlisted in the army. My mother finally gave up and sold the farm in 43. I enlisted too, and I dropped out for the last time, John said without emotion. I've been Junior ever since. You don't remember anything about Axel? I asked. I didn't say that, Junior replied. I don't remember anything about him during the war. I remember him in Korea. He was some kind of an intelligence officer who didn't have to wear a uniform. He ran around acting like a big-time big shot. I was a platoon sergeant, and he didn't know me from dirt, but I knew about him. I heard he got a medal at Chosun, Howard said. For a second, I thought Junior was going to swallow his chew. Some of it must have gone down the wrong pipe because he started to cough. It even took a few seconds for him to catch his breath, and even then he was wheezing, his face bright red. Son of a bitch never got a medal at Chosun. I saw him driving a jeep south so fast that he got windburn. Probably never even heard a gunshot, just ran for it when he heard rumors that the Chinese were thinking about coming across the border. Junior pointed his walker toward the dining room and took a few steps before turning back. I may have only been a junior, but I wasn't yellow. Howard watched Junior disappear into the dining room, saying, Junior certainly wasn't yellow. He was awarded a Silver Star and a Purple Heart on Okinawa and spent a couple months in a Navy hospital after the war. He stayed on in the Marine Corps Reserve and volunteered for Korea. He was a gunnery sergeant at the Chosun Reservoir when the Chinese overran his platoon. He held a rearguard position while his regiment withdrew. After the ceasefire, one of the guys from his platoon was released from a North Korean POW camp and told the story about Junior firing a machine gun until the barrel melted before he reluctantly pulled back. He was wounded but kept firing his rifle and made sure that every wounded Marine was taken along. Because all the officers in his company had been killed and there was no one over the rank of corporal to corroborate the story, the Marine Corps decided that they couldn't nominate him for the Medal of Honor, but he got a Navy Cross. I could hear the diminutive man wheezing as he pushed his walker away. Junior seems... Let me tell you something, Peter. It's not the guys who look like John Wayne who are the heroes. I've seen big, strapping guys break into tears and cry for their mothers when they got caught in an artillery barrage. On the other hand, I've seen the mousiest little guys race into withering fire to throw a buddy across their shoulders and run back to cover. Howard tapped his chest. Heroism is all about heart, and Junior has a lot of heart. I nodded and stepped away before Howard could see me shaking. The discussion of Junior's feats had me flashing back to Iraq with roadside bombs flipping Humvees and Marines with missing limbs lying in the road. I heard again the panicked voices calling, Corman! As I raced through the gunfire. The dining room with its linen-covered tables, each sporting a single carnation, was abuzz with the sound of voices and clattering dishes. The decor was knotty cedar with huge open timbers across the ceiling. Stuffed deer heads and lake trout, donated by the residents, made the room feel like a hunting lodge. Floor-to-ceiling windows and sliding glass doors looked east. On a clear day, Lake Superior was visible in the distance past a line of white pines. Flory, the only African-American person working in the facility, moved from table to table, making sure the flowers were centered on each table and straightening each tablecloth. I ducked into the kitchen and considered a cup of the Power Pot, the chef's special morning coffee. Instead, I took a banana from a fruit bowl that was about to be delivered to the reception area. The smell of frying potatoes, bacon, and vegetable soup mingled into a mélange that wasn't sitting well with the backflips my stomach was doing from last night's Jack Daniels discussion, the morning's Mountain Dew, not to mention the visit from Axel's apparition. I quickly peeled the banana and stuffed it in my mouth, hoping it might stabilize the queasiness. The kitchen hummed with activity as the waitstaff grabbed platters of Danish pastries and muffins for delivery to the tables. The kitchen staff clattered pots and pans as they cleaned up after breakfast and started preparations for lunch. The cooks moved like the gears of a well-oiled machine with little wasted motion or conversation. Russell, the dishwasher, was busily scrubbing pots and humming an atonal song. Racks of stainless steel utensils hung over a row of kettles warming on a huge stove. Across the room, Carla Telker, the baker, clothing and face liberally floured, was pulling dozens of rolls from the oven. "Pete, you look like crap." I turned to face whoever was making me aware that the feeling on my insides was being telegraphed to the outside. Angie Lafont, a petite girl whose brown hair was tied up inside a hairnet, was staring at me like she expected an answer. I opened my mouth, but there really wasn't anything to say except, "Yeah." Angie was one of the cooks, and her white apron was covered with multicolored splatters. She carried an odor that reminded me of Brussels sprouts, which made me reach for another banana. "Did you eat anything for breakfast?" she asked. I trimmed the mold off a piece of toast. "You ate moldy toast?" she asked, shaking her head. "I think that ginger tea and soda crackers might be a better choice than a banana and coffee." Without a wasted motion, she put the banana back in the bowl, tapped a cup of hot water from an urn, dropped a tea bag into the cup, and scooped up three cellophane-wrapped packages of soda crackers. She handed them to me and nodded toward the kitchen exit. "Take those out to the patio and sit there for a while." "Thanks." "I'm not being kind," she said as she ushered me toward the door. "I don't want you to hurl in my kitchen." Len was on the far side of the patio, filling the bowl of his pipe with tobacco. The pipe filling was obviously a ritual. He carefully tamped the tobacco and tested the draw before striking a match and slowly inhaling, then blowing a stream of smoke skyward. His uniform was rumpled like he'd slept in it, and his eyes were drooping with fatigue. He looked up at me, apparently reveling in the nicotine rush. He watched silently as I ripped open the cellophane wrappers off two packs of crackers and stuffed them in my mouth. I was taking a sip of tea when he finally spoke. "Pete, you look like crap." "That seems to be the consensus. The cook told me to leave the kitchen before I hurled." I took a sip of tea, hoping to stave off another wave of nausea. "By the way, Barnes and Harris got quite a chuckle out of me telling them that you didn't want them to walk all over the evidence." The corner of Len's mouth twitched in what might have been a smile. "Harris said he wasn't even sure if you were going to wet yourself or run." "Yeah, it was a treat for all of us." "You told me yesterday that you'd stopped smoking," I said, eyeing his pipe. "Yesterday," he replied, "I wasn't trying to solve the first murder in this town since Frenchman Jacques stabbed a guy off an ore boat over the affections of a dance hall girl." "Have you got any leads?" I asked, unwrapping the last cracker package. "The murder weapon appears to be a narrow knife, sharp on both edges like a stiletto." Len drew another drag on the pipe and blew the smoke to the side. "How goes your assignment? Do you have anything for me?" he asked as he pulled out the tobacco tamper and again went through the ceremony of carefully packing the bowl of the pipe before relighting it. I'm a little surprised at the resentment that a few of the residents had for Axel, but I doubt that any of it was deep enough to be a murder motive. Give me some specifics. Well, Howard Johnson didn't seem to have much time for Axel. Len gave me a tell-me-more motion with his pipe-wielding hand. Well, he said that Axel wasn't really a Swede. He pretended to be a Swede, but his family emigrated to Finland when it was a Swedish territory, and the whole group became pariahs who were disliked by both the Swedes and the Finns. He also said that he thought Axel might have collaborated with the Nazis. Then Junior Dahlin made a comment like he didn't think that Axel deserved the Korean War medal he always bragged about. Interesting, Len said as he tapped the tobacco plug from the pipe into the urn and took out his spiral notebook. The only thing disturbed in Axel's apartment was the picture of him getting a medal pinned on his chest. It was smashed on the floor. How angry was Howard? Len asked after scribbling a note. Howard is always very proper. He never lost his temper, but he made a derogatory comment that he apologized for as soon as it was out of his mouth. The comment about being a Swede Finn is interesting, Len said, tapping his pen on the table. Stella Ahonen had a birthday party about the time of Axel's death, and there were an extra 24 or 30 people of Finnish extraction here. I was just tracing down all who had signed in on the guest register. It seems there were at least a dozen more who didn't use the register. That's got to be ancient history, I said. Who would carry a grudge from the 1940s to commit a murder now? You ever hear of the Hatfields and McCoys? Len asked as he returned the notebook to his pocket. I think they feuded for 200 years, and I'm not sure it's over yet, he said, slipping the unlit pipe into his pocket. Is there anything else? Hazel Packer accused Axel of philandering. Len choked and then snorted. You're kidding! Deputy Barnes said that his father was quite a Casanova in his nursing home. He suggested that we check Axel's prescriptions for little blue romance pills. Len tipped his head back and looked at the sky. After a few seconds, he shook his head and looked down. Women use poison. A knife is a man's weapon. Whistling Pines, Chapter 4. Amid their normal daily activities, I tried to corner each of the remaining 10 or so male residents to assess their feelings about Axel. It was mostly an unsettling exercise in futility, with five of them having short-term memory issues. Gary Red Shida answered his door with a look of confusion. Is it Thursday already? He asked. He still had a full head of hair, which had once been red, garnering his nickname. Now it was mostly white with a brassy undertone. He'd apparently forgotten his morning shave, and white whiskers covered his face. He wore a quilted white T-shirt that barely covered his barrel chest and rainbow-colored suspenders that kept his blue jeans from slipping off. It's only Monday morning, I replied. We'll go to Betty's Pies, like always, on Thursdays, but I thought I'd see how you were doing. Lots of the residents are stirred up over Axel's death. Gary nodded knowingly. Come on in and sit. I'm a good listener, and you can tell me how you're feeling. After every few words, he had to push his upper dentures back into place with his tongue, making a sound like a dog with peanut butter stuck to the roof of his mouth. Gary's apartment was a small studio apartment like Axel's, with a sliding pocket door dividing the bedroom portion of the apartment from the living room. He had a few clean coffee cups and plates drying in the sink. Whistling Pines had people in a variety of living and dining arrangements. Gary chose to prepare breakfast and lunch for himself and ate his evening meal in the dining room. Others, like Axel, ate every meal in the dining room. He had a stack of the styrofoam cups from the cafeteria stacked on the counter. Gary, I stammered, trying to frame the question properly. You don't bring those used cups back to the cafeteria, do you? Oh, no, the cafeteria has lots of them. I wash them up and bring them to the food shelf for the workers. They can't afford coffee cups, and they really appreciate getting these nice plastic ones. How well did you know Axel? I asked. It's a small town, you know, Gary said with a hint of an accent that sounded more like the movie Fargo than any specific ethnicity. I've probably been bumping into him for decades. I can't really say the exact moment that we met, if that's what you're asking. Gary's smile lit up. Say, would you like a cup of coffee? I looked at the stack of plastic cups with apprehension. Thanks, but I've had my limit of caffeine for today. Were you and Axel friends? I asked, trying to steer the conversation back on track. Not so much, Gary said, wrinkling his nose as he sat in his recliner. He was full of himself and liked to talk big about things. I've seen what money he made and how he made it, and I didn't have much time for his nonsense. Nonsense? I've got a lot of respect for people who've worked hard to get ahead. Axel's not on that list of people. He reached into the side pocket of his recliner and pulled out a stack of papers. I keep some stuff that interests me, he said. Most were advertisements for hearing aids or old newspaper headlines about the Minnesota Twins. He sorted through the stack and found a newspaper clipping that he passed to me. The headline was, Landlocked Developer. The article was only a few paragraphs long and said that a land developer had purchased a prime piece of real estate that overlooked Lake Superior with plans to build a vacation condo development to bring in vacationers from the cities. He hit a snag when he tried to build a driveway across the land between his development and the highway. The title to the land stated that there was an agricultural easement. The owner of the blocking property had fought the developer in court and kept him from building a driveway. I handed the clipping back to Gary and asked, "Does this have something to do with Axel?" "Axel owns the land the easement crosses." "So he's been holding up the development of the landlocked property?" "He's been keeping a lot of good people from having good-paying construction jobs. He's keeping a whole bunch of people from making some money on construction materials, and he's keeping more tourists from coming here and putting money into our local economy." "I suppose he was getting lots of pressure to sell a property or an easement," I said, thinking about the number of enemies that strategy would make. "He told me that he'd never considered selling. He was happy just to be a pain in the butt, knowing he was causing an ulcer for this developer who already has a couple $100,000 spent on building plans, land, and building permits." Axel used to laugh about it. "Sounds like it could be a murder motive to me," I said, my mind reeling with the number of people who might have been impacted by Axel's intransigence. "Don't forget his kids," Gary added. Axel was proud that he never shared a penny with them, and here he sat on a piece of swampy property that could be worth over $100,000 to the developer. I'd say that might be motivation to get rid of a dad who spent his whole life making everyone he touches miserable. "Did anyone else have a motive to kill Axel?" Gary's eyes twinkled. "I can't remember the year, but if you check the newspapers from deer hunting season in the late 60s, you might find an article about a tragic hunting accident. Axel was part owner of a little bar south of Duluth that wasn't doing very well, and someone mistook his partner for a big buck and shot him dead. Axel hadn't fired his gun, so he wasn't a suspect, but there weren't any other hunters near the two of them. Lucky for Axel, they'd bought business life insurance policies on each other, and Axel collected 10 times what the little bar was worth. Pity that the widow hadn't had the foresight to get insurance, too. Of course, her plight wasn't Axel's problem. I heard he got generous and bought 3 bus tickets to Minneapolis so she could take the kids to live with her sister. I have a hard time seeing Axel with lots of money, I said. If he had the money you're talking about, he could have been living in a fancy house with a housekeeper instead of in a studio apartment here. That would be a violation of Axel's first rule. You don't get rich by spending money.
You have been listening to Episode 3 of Whistling Pines by Minnesota author Dean Hovey. There will be a total of 15 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in again next time for more from Whistling Pines. If you miss an episode during the reading of this book, you may find the previous week's episodes posted each weekend on our website, ktwh.org. Under the Programs tab, near the top of the home page, just look for Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down menu under Programs.
I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue. I knew that you'd love me as long as you wanted. And then someday you'd leave me for somebody new. Worry, why do I let myself worry? Wondering what in the world did I do? I'm crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. I'm crazy for trying and crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you. I'm crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. I'm crazy for trying and crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you.